everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to learn from an expert and hopefully expand our way of thinking in the world and to sharpen our critical thinking skills. Today is certainly no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you John Fredrickson, who is a psychotherapist with over 25 years experience. He practices, he teaches, he supervises, he does any number of things. We're going to ask him to tell us more about what he does. John Fredrickson, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, my pleasure, absolutely. And John, tell us a little bit more about your background, the kinds of psychotherapy that you practice.
Yeah, I practice a kind of therapy known as intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. It's designed to be a little quicker than most kinds of therapy in the sense that we try to maintain a very clear therapeutic focus. You know, oftentimes people have a misconception that therapy is two people coming down to sit down and, you know, engage in some chit-chat and intellectualize about the past and so on. Whereas in this model, we understand that, we suffered in life. We've had losses, we've had disappointments, you know. And in response, you know, we have feelings that arise. And oftentimes what happens is that rather than face the difficult challenges of our life and face the feelings that come up and face reality, we have ways to avoid reality, to avoid the pain in our lives and avoid the conflicts we need to face. And so the theme of my book is really the lies we tell ourselves, meaning that when we avoid the truth, when we avoid challenges, when we avoid difficult feelings, we tell ourselves little lies to avoid those truths. And so the point of the book is that we really become ill because of the lies we swallowed or the lies we tell ourselves. And that the way to become well is to see those lies, let go of them, and to face what we usually avoided.
Well, certainly, I would suggest that in today's world, the notion of telling lies to yourself about yourself in an attempt to get through your day is a relatively popular pursuit. So as I am looking at your book, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, How to Face the Truth, Accept Yourself, and Create a Better Life, can I assume that there are some people a little unnerved by the title?
Oh, of course, because after all, it's disturbing. It's disturbing to think that we could be lying ourselves. And I think the thing to keep in mind is we almost never know that we're doing it. We almost never are doing it on purpose. You know, it's like a woman whose husband is having many affairs, and he keeps promising to her that he's going to stop. And she says, you know, but he said he's going to stop. Now, in that way, she's listening to what he says, but she's ignoring what he does. And that's a very simple way that we can lie to ourselves. Now, she doesn't wake up in the morning thinking, how can I lie to myself? But she may not see that when she listens to his words, she ignores his deeds. And that's the way she lies to herself. So it's little things like that, you know, when you add them up, it's very disturbing to realize that we could be lying to ourselves and we don't know it.
Well, it is disturbing, and certainly in that example that you give, I mean, there are any number of people who have, as you well know, have spent years in relationships, whether it's infidelity or something else, years in relationships that weren't a good fit for them, but tell themselves perhaps it's a series of lies about why they stay, and that's not healthy at all.
Right, exactly. And you know, we've either done it ourselves or we've seen people do it, you know, where we stay with someone, say, who isn't good for us, right? And, you know, you have to wonder, why is it that we stay with someone who's not good for us? And the reason is we may know someone isn't good for us, but we wait for that person to become our fantasy, someone good, you know? Or we may pay attention to the good they actually do. And there's always something good about that person. So what we might do is we'll pay attention to what's good, but then we ignore what's bad. And in that way, then we lie to ourselves. We'll say, well, but he does this, and he does that, or he does that. Each of those things is true, of course. But then we'll ignore what's bad. And that's a way we can lie to ourselves. So in that sense, you know, there's lots of little ways that seem not so important, but once you lie to yourself enough in these little ways, pretty soon you find yourself, you know, stuck in a relationship that's not good for you.
So, again, just to make it clear, what you're saying, or to make it, to underscore it rather, what you're saying is that these lies that we tell ourselves are not necessarily intentional, that we do them unconsciously, perhaps in our view that it's a way to protect ourselves from what we really don't want to see or don't want to feel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it's just not uncommon at all for someone to say that, you know, for instance, he shouldn't be having affairs. And we could certainly agree with that on a moral point of view. Yeah, he shouldn't be having affairs. But the problem is when we say he shouldn't be having affairs, we're saying reality shouldn't be the way it is. And in that way, then we actually align to ourselves. So someone could say, you know, he shouldn't be having affairs. And we might easily just, yeah, I agree, yeah, he really shouldn't be doing that. But a therapist would say something like, huh, your husband shouldn't be having affairs. Is that true? And the patient might say, yes. And the therapist go another step further. So your husband shouldn't be doing what he's doing. And we might still say yes. And then the therapist would say, So reality shouldn't be what reality is. Is that true? And then the patient would have to start thinking. And the therapist might say, look, a lot of days I don't like reality myself. All I have to do is look at the newspaper in the morning, and already I'm not liking reality. But could we agree that as long as we ignore reality, reality won't be ignoring you, right? Or we might say something like, have you ever noticed when we fight reality that reality always wins? So in that sense, then we might have to help someone say, yeah, we wish reality weren't that way, but since this is how reality is, your husband is having affairs, could we agree that we may need to face this reality rather than hoping that it would go away?
You know, what I'm struck by, John, as you give us an example of what you're talking about, is the sort of natural, easy way in which you shift from author / psychotherapist to teacher and guider. And it's just interesting to listen to the ease with which you switch from one hat to another, teaching us all the while.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of times people think, well, therapy is a different kind of conversation, and it's just different in one sense, is that, you know, we're socialized oftentimes to kind of let lies go by. You know, it's like we've all heard a relative say something that's not true, or they'll have some excuse, and we let their excuses go by. We're, in fact, good socialization is not interrupting people's lives or defenses. A therapist has to find a way to talk about these uncomfortable truths, and not from a position of judgment, because, you know, us therapists, we're not any better than anyone else. It's just that we're in a position sometimes to see things and find a way to talk about these lies. And the thing is, what are these lies? All of us, to some degree, at certain points, tell ourselves lies to avoid painful truths in our lives. It's just being human. And so no therapist is ever in a position to judge or condemn you in any way, because each of us has done it. And, you know, here I am. I told lies my past, and sad to say, I probably will. In fact, I can just guarantee I will again in the future. It's just human. So in that sense, it's a kind of a conversation between two humans, and both of us, as all people do, struggle to face painful truths in our lives, painful feelings, painful facts.
So, again, what you're saying is that while we all, simply as a function of being human, have a tendency to lie to ourselves, the theory being in an effort to avoid pain, in fact, what it does is it creates pain.
Exactly. You know, I'm remembering a case in the book where a woman had a son who had been abused as a child, and as soon as she found out, the mother, you know, did everything possible to make sure he got the right treatment, right therapy, the whole thing. She really did a great job. And but afterwards, in his adulthood, the son really formed a belief that his all the suffering in his life was her fault, and that you know, because of her own tragic past, she started to feel guilty, like it was her fault that he created his problems as an adult. And so, in a way, he kind of blackmailed her, and, you know, so she'd be paying for his therapy, she'd be paying for his kids going to school, she'd be paying for this and this and this and this. It just went on and on. And she was lamenting to me about how she would be paying for the kids' school, and then he would let them stay home, and they just watch TV together, and she'd be very upset by this. And she said, he's got to change. I said, a son who hasn't changed for the last 4 years has to change. Is that really true? And she says, no, it really, really is true. And I said, well, you know, a son who hasn't changed for 40 years really doesn't have to. It looks like you've been nominated to see reality.
So in some respects, you know, his interesting sense of reality benefited him in that he was able to not take responsibility for himself or just the functions of daily living as an adult male parent.
Yeah.
And she got to suffer for things that were actually his.
Exactly. I said, you know, your son is an arsonist. You know, he has set his life on fire. And he keeps asking you to put out a fire that he keeps setting. And you can't put it out because he keeps setting it. And then, you know, she said, you know, it just doesn't seem to make any difference how much money I send him. We had the same problem. And I said to her, well, you know, he discovered that not forgiving you pays very well. And after you've sent him something like $200,000 over the last 30 years, we can really see that not forgiving you is really a good business for him. At which point she had to laugh because she couldn't realize, wow, paying him actually reinforced this destructive behavior.
So,
now, was she trying to lie herself? Absolutely not. She couldn't see the way she was caught. That's the thing. I think a lot of times it's easy as outsiders to judge people, but, you know, she really didn't see how he was playing her. She really couldn't see how she was. In a sense, she was hoping if she could pay him enough, he could finally forgive her. And, of course, what she had to do was really forgive herself. Because the forgiveness she needed to give herself could never come from him.
What I'm also noticing is that as you describe interactions that you've had with your clients, you're pretty direct.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your recommendation?
Well, it's sort of like when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror is awfully direct. You know, when I look in the mirror, it's not like, it never says to itself, you know, John probably is, you know, it's going to be a hard day for John. Let's maybe not show quite so much balding on his head. Let's color up a few of those gray hairs. Let's Photoshop a few of those wrinkles, you know. It's like the mirror, it's very direct. It just is what it is. You know, it's funny when we talk about directness. It's like it reminds me another case in the book where a woman was coming for supervision, and a tragic case where her patient had been having surgery for cancer, and then, tragically, the surgeon made a mistake and nicked some tumors within these cancer cells. Spread through the whole body, so now she really had a fatal illness and was going to die soon. And the therapist was wondering, whether it'd be too much to talk about dying, talk about the cancer, talk about death, and so on. And I pointed out that cancer didn't worry about whether it was too direct. You know, it's like a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and, cancer didn't call me up a couple years in advance, say, hey, John, we're thinking of making a visit, and we're wondering when would be a good time to schedule a cancer visit. You know, it's just, in a sense, life is very direct. It just happens. We worry about being truthful, but life is being truthful every day. We think, oh, this is too much. And I always ask people, is that true? You know, the therapist thought it would be too much to talk about death and cancer and so on. And I said, you know, it's not too much for you to talk about it because it's already happened. She has cancer. She is dying. So it's already happened. It's can you talk about what's already happening?
So in that instance, it sounds like it may have been a combination of the therapist being concerned for her client, but also having some discomfort herself in terms of how to bring this up and how to work with the client on clearly what you're saying are truths in place right as we speak.
That is so true. I mean, you know, the thing is, therapy is not a head-to-head sharing of thoughts. It's really a heart-to-heart communication of two humans facing the most painful truths of life. And, you know, as a therapist, you know, the patient is facing, death and cancer. And can the therapist face that too, right? In a sense, it's like the therapist has to take the patient's hand, and then we walk together into this dark forest that's scary. But that requires a certain amount of emotional courage, certainly from the patient, but also from the therapist. You know, for instance, I'll give an example. You know, you're worried about being direct, and it may be just my experience, but I'm finding oftentimes when we're not direct about what happens, it causes a lot of suffering. You know, for example, there was a person I saw who, because of very tragic events in her early life, really retreated from people and trusted them. And she had this relationship with a baby blanket, and she would talk to this baby blanket, okay? This became her best friend. And she retreated from people, and that was her most important relationship. And she would bring that baby blanket to her office, to the therapy offices, and people would talk about the blanket and so on and so forth, okay? So she meets with me, and she's had decades of therapy that didn't help. And I said, well, that makes sense. And she said, why? I said, because your blanket is your therapist. You have had a very tragic history. It would be too much for anyone. And how wonderful as a little girl, you found a strategy to let this blanket be your barrier between you and reality to protect you. And that is wonderful that you found that solution as a child. But the problem is that as an adult, this blanket that was really your best friend has now become your worst enemy. Because as long as you avoid reality, you live in this prison. And as long as you avoid reality, you never learn to deal with it. Well, as she said, she was shell-shocked. No one had been that direct with her. You know, they would let her have the blanket around her and so in a way, in her therapy, people have been actually allowing her to avoid the very thing that she needed to face. It's because she said, I don't want to become an adult. And I said, well, that makes sense. None of us do. You know, adulthood is very overrated. I mean, paying bills, mortgages, the pain of marriage and having kids. I mean, it's just, you know, there's a lot. But, you know, the problem is when you avoid reality and avoid aging and avoid all of the truth, we suffer. And so, in a way, she was shell-shocked, but at the same time, she was relieved because she realized I didn't treat her like a hot flower. I treated her like someone who had the capacity to face what she'd been afraid to face. Because in a sense, when we pussyfoot around, you know, the patient is afraid they can't deal with reality. So if we pussyfoot around, we give them the idea, yeah, you probably can't.
And hence, the lies we tell ourselves, the name of your book, the lies we tell ourselves, how to face the truth, accept yourself, and create a better life by John Fredrickson. We will return to this conversation with John in just a moment. To run from is where we need to rest. And certainly for many of us, resting in the thing that we fear is the last thing that we want to do. What do you mean when you say we need to rest into where we wish to run from?
That is a great question. You're so right. I mean, you know, that's why I keep saying, you know, it's simply human. I mean, we avoid what's uncomfortable. But the problem is oftentimes we need to face what we're uncomfortable with. You know, we could take a look, you know, for instance, with this woman I just described, being an adult, facing the challenge of adulthood. Okay, it's very uncomfortable, but she needed to face that discomfort for the sake of her growth. Or we take a woman whose husband is having affairs. She, rather than relate to the husband who has affairs, she relates to the fantasy of how she wishes he was, right? So she says, well, but he shouldn't be having affairs. So she's relating to the husband, the person who she thinks he should be. She says, well, he promised, you know, not to have affairs. So she relates to his promises rather than to reality. And we can certainly understand, you know, because if she simply rests and sits with the fact that this is a person who repeatedly has affairs, that's very painful.
Indeed.
That's very uncomfortable. And yet, by resting with reality, by letting go of the lies, and resting with a terrible discomfort, then she can speak the truth with the truth, and respond according to the truth. That might be an ability to confront him in a new way. It may be in recognizing that she needs to leave. But at least it would be based on reality. Sometimes, you know, a person like this confronts someone and he says, oh, well, I won't do it again. And then she might have to say something different. In the past, she would lie to herself and say, okay. This time she might say, well, I appreciate your promise, but I've learned before that I can't believe your promises. I can only believe your deeds, because you've already showed me, yeah, that your words don't mean anything. So at this point, I wish I could believe what you said, but what I've learned is I have to believe what you do. And what you do is you have affairs. Now, the two of them, for the first time, are having an honest conversation. And as a result of her being honest with him, maybe he will relate to the truth. And by relating to the truth, they can both get married to reality. But if he wants to lie, or he says, well, that's not true, or it's no big deal, or it's, you know, he tells some kind of lies like that, then she'd realize, okay, he's divorced from reality. And therefore, he's actually divorced from me, since I'm part of reality. So I might as well finalize the divorce and leave. So in that sense, we need to stick with what's uncomfortable, because the discomfort itself is giving us important information. It's usually painful information, but then again, we need to face that painful information so that it's sort of like if you have a rock in your shoe, right, and it's bothering your foot, it's very painful. It's very important to pay attention to that pain, so you realize, oh, there's a rock in the shoe, and then you can take your shoe off and get the rock out. But if you keep ignoring the pain, you know, you could really damage your foot. The problem is when we have that rock in our shoe, the implications are usually so painful that we just keep ignoring the rock, and then our pain continues.
And certainly the same is true in our emotional lives. What I hear you also saying is that as your client was, you know, certainly advancing the truth, advancing reality, she was also empowering herself.
Absolutely, because lies disempower us. Lies say that you have to continue to suffer. You must suffer forever, right? And when we can face our emotions, like when she could face the grief and say, wow, the husband I married is gone. There's this other guy I'm married to now, an unfaithful man. When we can grieve that loss, it allows us to relate to the truth, and then we don't have to suffer anymore. There's the one thing I make a point of in the book is that there's the pain of life, you know, there's the pain of illness, loss, and death, but most of our suffering is really self-inflicted, so we need to figure out what lies am I telling myself that are keeping my suffering. So she thinks he'll change, he really shouldn't be this way. She's going to suffer. Or with my patient who thought, I love my blanket, it's good, I don't want to grow up, and so on. Those lives were perpetuating her suffering because, you know, she was, in a way, waiting for the childhood she never had. But the problem was that her adulthood was going by.
Are there particular lies that people frequently tell themselves?
There's a lot. One of the most common ones is that something shouldn't be happening.
Okay.
Or we say, I can't believe this is happening. And in response, I say, huh, you can't believe that reality is happening? Is that true? Right? Another is that we say something shouldn't be happening. And, you know, we're not in charge. It's like we're saying something shouldn't be happening. It's like saying, well, if I was in charge of reality, reality wouldn't be happening this way. And I would probably agree with you. But the fact is that neither you or I are in charge of reality, and it is showing up this way, even if we don't like it. So we have to deal with it the way it is. So oftentimes people say reality shouldn't be happening this way, and then they wait for reality to show up the way they want, and it doesn't. Or they wait for people to show up the way they want. I think a very common lie we tell ourselves is in relationships, where, for example, in the book, I talk about a woman who is really angry because her husband always likes to watch the football games all day on Saturday and Sunday, and she's quite angry about this, and she was saying, he shouldn't be watching all this TV. And I say, so a husband that likes watching TV shouldn't watch TV, is that true? And she says, yes, uh-huh. So then the reality of your husband shouldn't be what the reality of your husband is. Well, no, I'm not saying that, but he just shouldn't watch TV, you know? And I said, and she says, do you watch TV? Football? I says, no, but the question is, why shouldn't he watch it if he likes it? Well, I think it's terrible. And I said, well, since you think it's terrible, obviously, you shouldn't watch TV. Shouldn't watch football on TV. And she said, well, you know, he says, I keep nagging him so much, he's even threatened divorce. And I said, well, it makes sense, I said, because you actually don't love the husband you have. You want him to turn into the husband you want, and then you'll promise to love that husband. So in that sense, either you'll have to divorce your fantasy of how you want him to be, or you'll have to divorce him, you know, or he'll divorce you because he'll realize you don't love him. You're in love with an idea that you want him to become. But it's a lot of times we don't realize it's not other people's job to become our fantasy. You know, it's their job to be them. If we can't love them the way that they are, we should let them go so we can find someone who can love them the way they are. So I'd think one of the big problems we get into in relationships is it's very easy to convert your spouse into a home renovation project where you can nag and harass them for quite some time to turn into your fantasy. And of course, they never will because, you know, they're not your fantasy, they're them.
And certainly there are more than a fair share of people who do see their partners, their children, their next-door neighbors as a renovation project.
Hey, I've done it. I think almost all of us is probably, you know, maybe conservatively speaking, about 99% of us have done it to some degree with somebody. You know, I don't want to convey, like, it's some people. Or, you know, this is what we humans do. There's nothing unique about doing this. I've done it. Everybody I've ever met has done it to some degree with somebody. It's just in a way to kind of, you know, it's very important to not get caught up like only certain weird people. No, we do this. This is a real struggle facing reality, and especially in intimate relationships.
What do you mean when you say anxiety is a sign of the unspoken?
You know, it's interesting. When we think of anxiety, we tend to think of like fear. You know, like if a tiger showed up in our living room, we would feel fear. Wow, there's a subjective danger, right? When we feel anxiety, it's not usually because a car is about to hit us. It's not because a tiger has entered the house. When we feel anxiety, feel really nervous, it's usually a sign that there's some feeling or issue that we're not aware of that's threatening us. And once we can face whatever that feeling or issue is, we don't have to feel anxious because then we actually see what the problem is. You know, for instance, this woman I was describing who was paying so much money so that her son wouldn't be, you know, blackmailing her, she was very anxious. Now, she didn't realize what was making her anxious, which was that she was, on one hand, she was angry with the son, which she wasn't really able to see. That made her anxious. And the other thing, her way of dealing with her anger was to try to buy him off, which, of course, was very destructive to her and was draining her money and threatening her own livelihood. So she was doing something. In a way, she thought the danger was something else. Actually, the danger was the feeling she had inside and this dangerous response she had of, you know, throwing away her money, trying to pay him off, which was threatening her.
It is indeed interesting how effortlessly we as human beings can lie to ourselves, and how much we don't realize it. The lies we tell ourselves, how to face the truth, accept yourself, and create a better life. When you say accept yourself, you're talking about accepting the reality of who you are and where you are in your life in this moment. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, because that's reality, okay? I have to accept, you know, how I appear at this stage in my life. I have to accept the mistakes I make, the shortcomings I have, the weaknesses I have, the strengths I have, everything. It's just, you know, when I look in the mirror in the morning, the mirror has no trouble accepting me. It just reflects what is. And a lot of times what happens, we have trouble, you know, like this woman, she had trouble accepting that she was angry with the son she loved. She had trouble accepting her guilt. She had trouble accepting that she was watching a son setting his life on fire and she couldn't put his fires out. You know, that's a very painful thing to watch, but it is reality. So, in a sense, we have trouble accepting ourselves really the way we are. And what we feel, like the woman whose husband's having an affair, she was angry with her husband. She had to accept that. And she was not wanting to accept her grief, you know, that she had really already lost the husband. She had, you know, in a sense, she was afraid they would get divorced. She didn't realize they already were divorced.
Indeed.
And that's why she felt so sad and so anxious. I mean, who wants to feel that? Nobody. You know, that's just human. Who would want to face that divorce had already happened? And of course, that when we avoid those feelings, they make us anxious, because anxiety, in a way, is like your alarm bell. It's saying, okay, look inside. There's something that you're needing to accept.
Is it possible that there are some folks who are so used to being anxious that the idea that they don't have to be is stressful in and of itself?
Absolutely. Of course it's stressful, because when they realize this suffering has been unnecessary, they realize in a certain unintentional way, this has all been unnecessary, and they've been almost inflicting suffering on themselves without intending to, and that's a very painful thing to see.
You say that in response to hardship, we often believe ourselves to be broken. So is that similar to what you were just talking about?
You know, that's a great point. Because, you know, like with the woman whose husband's having, you know, having an affair, she could afterwards, you know, patients tell me, I just feel like I'm broken. And oftentimes I'll say something like, no, you're not broken because you're right here. But your illusions are broken.
Mm.
Your fantasies, this fantasy of the husband you wanted, this illusion of the marriage that you thought you had, it is shattered into a thousand pieces on the floor. And that's what's broken. So a lot of times we think we have broken, and we haven't. But our illusions, our dreams, our visions have broken. But in a way, even though we can't see it at the time, that those visions, those dreams, when they break, they allow us to see the truth, and they reveal to us usually kind of a larger vision and a larger life that we could live as a result, so that we don't have to live trapped in those lies, in those illusions.
So, indeed, you know, we've been talking, I've been asking you about the stress of acknowledging that we lie to ourselves and how that impacts us. But as I think about it and as I listen to how you're discussing it, when we know that we tell ourselves lies, there's so much more hope, and we have so many more options than we had before when we were more wedded consciously or unconsciously to the lies. We make space for a different life.
Yeah, you know, I remember a woman I was working with, you know, and this is a woman who worked an insane number of hours. I mean, just a crazy workaholic, you know. And as we began to look at things, it turns out that she'd her mother had left when she was a very young girl. So she was raised primarily by her father. Yeah. And who was an extremely demanding man. But he worked under the illusion that somehow women were less significant or important than men. So her brother was idealized and given millions of dollars from the inheritance through a business. She, meanwhile, although extraordinarily bright and talented, was always ignored, was always treated like a second-class citizen, and in fact was not included in any of this money that went to the brother. And I was able to help her see that she, in all kinds of very subtle ways, she'd think, well, she wasn't good enough, she wasn't smart enough, she needed to try harder, she needed to work harder in therapy. And I would just say, is that true? Do you notice how, could this be a kind of violence you do to yourself here with me, saying that you should work harder, that you're somehow not doing this wellness? Could this be a form of cruelty to you? And as we kept working on this, it became clear she felt this tremendous rage towards her father, which she had really never felt. This father who she felt like if she only worked hard enough, she had gotten like two or three doctoral degrees just with the hope that she would get his admiration, which of course never came. So when she could face the truth of her anger and really let go of these lies, then this need to work so hard to prove something to a father to whom she could never prove anything, that all dropped away. And it was just tremendous relief that she could just respect herself as she was. She no longer had to look at herself through her father's eyes. She no longer had to wait for a deluded father to become non-delusional. And the tremendous relief of no longer having to torture herself to become something she could never become. because I pointed out, in a way, she'd always been lovable, but she was trying to become whatever fantasy she thought her father wanted to be, and she could never become not her.
Right. John Fredrickson, author of The Lies We Tell Ourselves. We will take a break, folks, and we will return to this very important conversation. So don't you go away. Of the fact that we're lying to ourselves. And certainly, I'm pretty clear that there are people listening who are saying, well, if I don't know that I'm doing it, how am I going to know that I'm doing it? And that brings me to another comment that you made in The Lies We Tell Ourselves, where you say to make sure that we notice the truth, life sends us messages. Anxiety, anger, sadness, depression, good and bad relationships, these are all messages that life is sending us. Say more about that.
Sure. If you're depressed, something you're telling yourself or doing to yourself is making you depressed. And whatever is making you depressed is some lie you're telling yourself. When you're anxious, whatever you're avoiding is what you need to face. So anything you tell yourself to make yourself avoid is a lie. You have to understand, a lot of times we think that feelings are our problems. Actually, they're oftentimes our resources. They tell us what's important. You know, grief reminds us of our capacity for love, that we love someone. Anger lets us know that a boundary has been crossed. Guilt reminds us that we need to repair a relationship. But oftentimes we avoid what makes us anxious. And the problem is that it's actually the avoidance is what's causing a problem. So anything you say that makes you want to avoid a particular feeling is most likely a lie. And that's a way to look at it. Anything that's making you feel worse most likely is a lie. A lot of times people say, well, I'm not good, I'm terrible, I'm fat, I'm ugly. You know, I'll say to people, could that be a critical thought? Could they be hurting you? And they'll say, well, that's true. Look, here I am, I'm fat, or I'm this, or I'm self-destructive. You know, and I'll make the analogy, you know, if you're a Whippet driving instructor, you know, and he says, oh, you need to make a left-hand turn a little bit here so you don't end up in a ditch. Okay. He says that once you make a little adjustment with the steering wheel and you're on the road. Now, the driving instructor won't remind you every 10 seconds, hey, you made a mistake back there. Hey, you made a mistake back there. Hey, you made a mistake back there. Because you'd realize, wow, this person is really sadistic and cruel, right? So my thought is when you make a critical comment to yourself, if you make it once or twice, that's just, you know, helping you get back on track. But when it's hundreds of times, we just have to face, yeah, it's a form of verbal abuse. It's just that you're the one who's doing the verbal abuse. So sort of keep things in mind, because I think oftentimes self-critical comments oftentimes masquerade as helpful. You know, we often think, oh, this is helpful, it's getting me back on track. But it's really not. It really doesn't. You know, you only need to hear something once or twice. Once it's 100 times, then it's a way of being cruel to yourself.
Then it is indeed a form of verbal abuse, because if that was coming to you from someone else, you perhaps would be more clear that that was an abusive interaction.
Exactly, and you'd be angry at someone. someone who's talking to you that way. Yeah. We just don't hear it when we nag and torture ourselves that way.
Very often not.
Another one is where people are worried about all kinds of terrible things that could happen in the future. They think it's planning, but, you know, it's like, okay, I worry, I think, oh, what's going to happen with my retirement? Okay, well, then I'll make sure to save money and put it in certain investments or whatever. Okay, fine. You think it once or twice, and then you take right action. But usually when people worry about things in the future, they do it all the time. And in that way, that's where we can misuse our imagination for the purpose of self-torture.
And self-torture is often something that you've learned early on in your life, or perhaps have learned from the world in which you live right now. You may have learned it from a boss or from a colleague.
Exactly. You know, if you grew up with people who thought the best way they could teach you was to scare you all the time, then you oftentimes will scare yourself all the time, thinking that this is a useful way to treat yourself and that it motivates you. But in fact, all it does is keep you in a chronic state of anxiety.
You tell this story of a wealthy man who was angry with his wife and had an affair, that his wife had an affair, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. There was an interesting commentary.
Yeah, well, and of course, feel free to chime in if I leave anything out. If I'm remembering rightly, yeah, it was a guy who was quite outraged that his wife had an affair. Now, she had been bringing up to him relationship problems for quite some time and kept blowing her off and ignoring what the couple therapist had said. And so, in a way, he, without realizing it, you know, was having an affair because he was in love with a fantasy that he wanted his wife to be and kept berating his wife for not showing it the way he wanted. So eventually, since he was having this affair in his own mind, he had an affair in reality, and then he got enraged, and he's saying, I can't stand it, you know. And what we began to see is he couldn't stand reality, but also he couldn't stand his wife the way she was, that he, rather than listen to her, he listened to his idea of how he thought she should be, right? So he really, in a sense, he was asking his wife to live in a kind of a dollhouse, and that she was supposed to fit some idea he had about how she should look, what clothes she should wear, what things she should say, what book she should read. So in a way, he wasn't married to his wife. He's married to the fantasy of how he wanted her to be. Needless to say, she realized he didn't love her. He loved this idea in his head. And so the struggle they had was, and that even, as I recall, even when she apologized for having the affair, he continued to torment and berate her, which helped to see that, you know, he really didn't want to listen to her. He in a way, wanted to continue to berate her. So, and it's a good example of oftentimes when there is an affair, when someone has had an affair, oftentimes the other person has had an affair too, but it's the one we don't see. It's where they're having an affair with the image they want their spouse to be.
And perhaps the image of what they think they should be as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, that is one of the big ones. I don't know if you run into this, but I certainly do. A lot of times people come to therapy hoping that therapy will sterilize them in a sense. You know,
sure.
It's almost like, I don't want to be this way. I don't want to feel these feelings. I don't want to experience these conflicts. You know, it's like saying, I don't want to be human. You know, if we're human, we have conflicts. If we're human, feelings come up, and oftentimes patients come in hoping, thinking there's something wrong to have conflict, that there's something wrong to have feelings, and in a sense hoping the therapy will somehow purify them, sterilize them of these feelings. You see the same thing with people who go into spiritual pursuits. They're hoping that through spirituality that they somehow will no longer have feelings like sadness or anger or whatever. There was this guy, John Wellwood, who called it spiritual bypassing, right? In the book, I talk about a guy who, through meditation and so on, was trying to become, you know, totally purified of anger and other feelings. But the problem is, since he ignored the anger all the time, then he would become this exploding doormat. You know, he'd be very submissive, and then all of a sudden there'd be this outburst of the rage that he had tried to bury. And so it's important to understand that therapy is not about continuing to reject your humanity. It's really about embracing and accepting everything that's inside us that we're trying to get rid of.
And I know that you know this, that many, many people come to therapy with the idea that either they're broken or their partner or their child is broken, mm-hmm. and that you, the therapist, will fix them and then all will be well.
Yeah. And of course, we don't need to be fixed, but we do need to be healed. And the way we're healed is by facing and embracing these feelings. You know, oftentimes people think, I need to be fixed, I'm broken. And what happens is that usually some fantasy we had about ourselves is broken. Maybe we lost a job, maybe we lost a marriage. Maybe we just got fired, you know. And so there's an idea we had about ourselves that I'm successful, or I have a good marriage, or someone loves me, or I'm really good at something, and that fantasy is broken. And so we mistakenly think we're broken and that we need to be fixed, or we don't need to be fixed, but we need to accept that a fantasy is broken and that we have to hold a funeral for this fantasy image we had of ourselves, or even a fantasy image of a child. You know, in the book I talk about a woman whose son, she has an autistic son, is 4 years old, and he was home for a while because he was sick, and then he had to go back to his group home. And when they were crossing the street one day, he almost got hit by a bus, and she yelled at him. She says, "You've got to be normal. You've got to look both ways on the street. You can't do this." And I said to her, "So a 40-year-old autistic son has to become normal. Is that true?" And she says, "Well, no." And I said, "Exactly." I said, we can both wish that we could un-autism your son, but we can't." And in a sense, you see, she was hoping that she could have a normal son instead of the autistic son, and that would never be the case. And I said, "So can we hold the funeral for the normal son you'll never have?" And of course, it was very painful for her to feel that grief. But once she could grieve the loss of the normal son she'd never have, then she could love her autistic son, who wasn't broken. He was just autistic. And then she could learn to love him. And then she no longer had to assign herself an impossible task of making him autistic. And she no longer had to assign him an impossible task of making him try to be autistic. He couldn't be, right? And so in a way, when she could let go of that lie, he has to be normal, when she could grieve the loss, she could love him as he is, and then he could be so much happier because he no longer had to become not him in order to become lovable to her.
Many times during the course of our conversation, you've reminded us that it is what it is. I mean, reality is not going to rewrite itself because you may find it unpleasant or uncomfortable. And certainly there are many, many people who say and believe, well, it is what it is. But rather than doing the what's true work, if you will, they just decide to put whatever it, quote unquote, is on a shelf. And they don't do the work. Can you speak to those folks?
Hey, we've all done it. I mean, you know, there's some days when the truth is so painful, you say, let me just put it up on the shelf and I'll deal with this tomorrow or next week or next year or never. I mean, you know, it's just so human. I've done it, and I'll probably do it again, sad to say. The problem is, well, certainly we can ignore reality. We do it all the time. And the fact is, reality doesn't really need us to pay attention to it. It will continue to be there. And when we feel ready to look at it, it will be there for us to look at. It doesn't go away just because we ignore it. So in a sense, yeah, take all the time you want, avoid it all as long as you want. It will still be there. It will still do what it does. So reality doesn't actually need us to pay attention to it in order for reality to exist.
There are, you know, several moments in the lies we tell ourselves where you say these huge things in these tiny little sentences. And it's really quite profound. And I'm going to quote another one to you and ask you to speak to it. You've said, "We die once from death, but 1,000 times from self-doubt." Wow, that is so powerful. Talk about that a bit, if you would.
You know, when we doubt our abilities, when we doubt our capacities, it's a form of psychological suicide. You know, we can see a cut on the wrist. It's an easy one to see. But we have this psychological form of suicide where we cut ourselves with 1,000 cuts of self-doubt. And it really, in a way, the hope and the energy and desire bleeds out of us through those little invisible cuts. It's no less severe and crippling. The problem is that many of us imagine that self-doubt helps us. But when it's repetitive and habitual, it's actually draining the soul of any kind of energy that we could bring to life and to our ventures. So it's when you think about it, if someone came to you and doubted you constantly and doubted everything about you, you become quite angry with that person. You realize, wow, this person is really very sadistic. You know, if you had a boss who's constantly doing that, you'd be very angry. Like, this is everyone that sit around saying, wow, this is a very cruel loss. Problem is, when we doubt ourselves, it's since we're doing it, and it sounds so rational to us, since it came out of our own head, we don't really see how cruel it is. We don't see it, that the effect is cruel, but the words themselves make sense. And the problem is, oftentimes we're bringing up things, you know, like, I could say, wow, I made this mistake, or I didn't do this right, and all those things are true. It's just that there's a danger when we can misuse our mistakes for the purpose of self-doubt, for the purpose of self-punishment.
John, I have to say that I am sad to say that the hour for us today has flown by. I am very hopeful that those who are listening and who are curious to learn more about what we've been discussing will take a look at The Lies We Tell Ourselves by John Fredrickson. And that's John, J-O-N. John, is there a website for the book or for you where folks can get more information?
You can order it at your favorite bookstore. You can get it online at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, terrific. Folks, John, again, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand at mindtalk.org. You can always go to iTunes and sign up for the podcast, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And folks, I remind you, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.